Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to another episode of Sci-Frights, the movie discussion podcast at the Interzone where horror meets science fiction. I am Liam Dunn. I am a screenwriter, film critic, and lifelong science fiction fan.
And my name is Dr. Lindsay Hallam. I am the course leader of the Film and Screen Studies degree at University of the Arts London, and I am an academic and author who specializes in horror cinema. So, we have just been to Fright Fest, which I'm pretty sure that this was our 12th year of going to Fright Fest. We actually arrived in London from Perth in Australia the day that Fright Fest started in 2013. And I think the day after we moved to London, we went to a Fright Fest screening.
I think we were in Leicester Square when it was happening and we were like, what's this? Yeah. A whole film festival dedicated to horror movies? Get out of here.
Yeah, I think I had heard about it, but yeah. Mm. And then I realized, oh, wait, yes, that's this.
Yeah.
And I think we started doing the whole festival probably around 2015, so yeah. 10 years ago. And most years we've gone and done the whole festival since then. There's been a few years we've had off. But anyway, so we did the whole festival, although I had to miss the last day. Mm. But usually at the London Film Festival, I end up catching a terrible cold. But at Fright Fest this year, I ended up, the last day I had to stay at home because I didn't think it was fair to spread it around, even though I'd obviously got it from someone.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I didn't want to be another carrier.
We're kind of doing our little end of festival wrap up, which is the first time we've done this for this podcast because we didn't have this last year. At this time, we're going to just go through some of the films that we really loved and discuss some of the emerging themes that we noticed from this crop of films, which is a really strong year, I think. Like, it's not always, not every film you go to see is great, and sometimes it can be very hit or miss, but this year I think I enjoyed 95, if not more, percent of the films that I saw this year.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, like, last year there were a few that were pretty good, but I remember last year thinking, oh god, look, I need a few more good films in here. And then of course last year the last film was The Substance, and that kind of came in as the closing film and kind of blew the roof off, the place. And it was one of my, probably one of my favorite screenings ever, seeing The Substance in a packed cinema in Leicester Square. But just for people who don't know what Fright Fest is that it is a festival that takes place in Leicester Square in London every August bank holiday weekend. It starts on Thursday evening with three films and then goes the Friday, Saturday, Sunday and Monday.
Yeah.
And there's films all day. And one of the things that I remember the first time, I think it was like maybe the second year, 2014, when we got a day pass, we didn't quite understand how it all works. You basically can get a day pass or a festival pass that gives you a seat in the main screen. And there's films scheduled pretty much all day, starting at around, 10:30. Yeah. And the last screening is at around 11 at night.
Yeah.
For Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But they also have discovery screens.
Discovery screens are, if you've got a festival pass or a day pass that guarantees you a spot in the main screen, you then at a certain time go and get discovery screen tickets. But it's not guaranteed that you'll get a seat. So these are usually like the more niche, more underground, lower budget films that the festival want to champion, which they don't think has the mass appeal that the main screen. It's basically for people who like the more like specific stuff, specific genre horror stuff. And they've also got like certain streams where it's people's debut features and things like that to kind of bring some people to the festival who might not normally be able to screen there. Some of these films also get a lot of word of mouth around them, so it can end up being that it sells out very quickly. So every year you always have discussions with other festival goers about, oh, I couldn't get ticket for that one, or I really wanted to see that. So you can get some real standout films in those discovery screens.
And that's the other thing about the festival is that there are I think about 4 screens playing films all the time. Yeah. So it's one of those things where you've got to look through the program and you've got to choose wisely. And mm-hmm. there's always a case where you end up getting FOMO where yeah. you've chosen to stay in the main screen, or you just decide to go for a Discovery film and something plays in the main screen that everyone's like, oh my God, that's amazing. So yeah, it always is a gamble of what film to choose. So there's heaps of films to choose from. So I ended up seeing about 12 films and you ended up seeing 15, about 15. I think. Yeah. One of the things that I think is the main kind of trend in horror at the moment, I think, is demonic possession films. Mm-hmm. I think the past kind of 5 or so years, there has been so many demonic possession films. I mean, people talk about how there are trends or certain types of films that are popular. Like, I think, you know, people talk about the torture porn films of like the 2000s, or also around the 2000s, you had the found footage films that kind of took off for a while. And I think, yeah, demonic possession is a big thing at the moment. I don't know why. I don't know whether it's just because The Conjuring was just so popular that everyone's just cashing in on that, or whether there's something else, like whether there is some kind of subtext. I don't know. Like, I don't know if people are feeling like, I don't know if it's like a loss of control yeah. that people are feeling, that, yeah, that something is overtaking, or that people feel that there are demonic forces that, you know, or we live in a time where suddenly people we love can suddenly be, you know, seem to be taken over by something. There are a couple of possession films, and one of them was an Australian film. And I mean, that's also because I'm working on the book on Australian horror at the moment. And in Australian films in particular, in the past like 5 or so years, there's lots of possession films. I think most obviously of like the 2 Philippou Brothers films, Talk to Me and Bring Her Back. Mm. But there's been a lot of possession films. And there was this really, I think, great film. If you had a wildly different opinion, there's a film called Salt Along the Tongue, which is about this young girl called Mattia. Something happens. She lives with her mom. Something happens and she ends up having to live with her aunt, who is her mom's identical twin, so looks exactly the same as her, played by the same actress. And her aunt is this lesbian who hosts a cooking show that's made with all these other women. So it's this film where there's pretty much no men in the film. I think there's 2 male characters and I don't even think you see their face. Mm. And it's very much about, because, you know, this is a cooking show, but like, yeah, Mattia and her mother, they're an Italian-Australian family. And so it is a lot about food, but it's also about kind of bonds between mother and daughter and things being passed down. But it's also about, I guess, like I remember thinking like this is the monstrous feminine or the abject theory in the movie. There's lots of eating and fluids mm-hmm. and also this whole idea of a curse being passed down from mother to daughter, and you can even go about, you know, the whole idea of the blood curse that's passed down from mother to daughter in terms of menstruation. Yeah, so there was all these kind of elemental things going on. But also you have in that these women that seem to be harnessing this other power. It's almost like a witchcraft, but it's a very kind of domestic form of witchcraft. I don't know. I keep thinking about this film. I really, like, the more I think about it, the more I think there's some really interesting things going on. But you didn't really get into it.
Well, no, I mean, it's just you either vibe with the film or you don't, and it's not a reflection on the film. It's just I kind of struggled a little bit with it. I felt it. I mean, I love a slow-paced film, but I just thought this was a little too slow for what it was trying to do. When I do think back on it, I do understand what they were doing, and, you know, and I just probably wasn't in the right headspace to watch it at that time. And then especially towards the end when it becomes clearer that it is kind of this possession thing, I felt it kind of was just adding on to a lot of other stuff that had already happened. And there was a lot of kind of stuff going on, which I don't think was entirely clear at certain times, even though it is supposed to be this atmospheric thing and this sensorial experience. I just wasn't on its wavelength. I wasn't in the headspace for it at the time, I guess.
Yeah, I think it definitely is if it does catch you in the right mood. But it definitely isn't like the fun thrill ride kind of film. It is very much vibes and, yeah, lots of sequences of people eating.
Yeah.
If watching people eating is like a fetish you have, or then you'd be really into it. But if it gives you the ick, yeah, then you would really struggle with this film because there's a lot of, a lot of eating. But yeah, it's directed by Parrish Maltofano, who is an Italian Australian, and didn't see his first film, Bloodshot Heart, which I believe is like a very giallo-esque. So there's a lot of Italian influences in his films, and in Salt Along the Tongue, it's obviously a very low budget, but it looks beautiful, and there's some amazing like split diopter and lighting and things. So
yeah, it's very well shot.
Yeah, maybe. it's very like stylized. But I think there's lots going on underneath. Mm. Another possession film, maybe not as successful, and it was a Discovery Screen film. It was one of those times where we were like, oh, let's take a chance on a Discovery Screen film. It's a film called Five, and I think it's probably, it's a horror comedy, but I think it probably leans more towards the comedy. I think horror comedy it can be really difficult.
I think it's not scary enough to be horror, and it wasn't funny enough to be a comedy, so it's a bit hard. It was like, it was not quite succeeding at both, in my opinion. I think it starts out with this kind of horrific cold open to suggest that there's going to be this thing coming up, and then it kind of forgets about it for a while, and then it brings it back, and then suddenly it becomes all about that.
So just say what the story is.
Yeah, so it's basically about an actress who's trying to make a comeback in the film industry by doing a really silly, like,
Hallmark
film, TV movie called Renovated Romance, where she's meets this hunky guy. She's about to get married, but she meets this hunky guy that she might actually be in love with more. But then you see a lot of it's all of the behind-the-scenes stuff where they're struggling. Everyone thinks all the pressure's on her to do this performance, and she's struggling from coming out of drug addiction and all these things. But what's happened is that she's also unleashed this demonic force that seems to be possessing her. So at first everybody thinks that she's just being a prima donna, or she's going back to her old ways, and they're trying to finish all the money men are stressing out. And this young woman comes in to shoot behind the scenes footage, and she sort of starts to investigate what's really going on. And it starts to affect the whole film crew as well.
So there's also like this weird infection that starts to, I don't know. So it just felt like there was some interesting, like, I think there was some like satire about Hollywood and about, you know, especially like aging actresses and how they're having to make this comeback and all the pressure and expectation and reputation. And also, I think poking fun at these Hallmark style rom-coms. There is the lead actor in it. He's pretty funny. Like, he has some, like, he's a real douchey guy, douchey actor, and he has some funny lines. And there's also when they start to research what's going on or where they're filming is where there was this plague or whatever. There's this Ghost Hunter YouTube channel that with these two women that they keep cutting to. And it was kind of funny because one of the main sponsors of Fright Fest was this YouTube channel where they obviously go and go. So there's this whole thing of ghost hunting on YouTube and stuff. There was some elements there, but it just didn't quite.
Yeah, I don't. Gel. It doesn't quite gel together. And I think also with the demon possession stuff, and I will say, Salt Along the Tongue actually gets it right, whereas Five doesn't, in terms of when you do demon possession stuff, it can come off, if you don't do it right, it can just come off really silly, or like unintentionally silly, or that it's just like you're just kind of rehashing what The Exorcist already did so well without any really bringing anything new to it. This, unfortunately, Five for me, it felt like it didn't come off like as scary as I think they hoped it would. And also it makes me think, like, well, why didn't they continue? If they're making fun of like romantic comedies, they should have tried to make fun of horror films as well, I suppose, and like maybe make the demon possession stuff kind of, you know, part of the satire in a way, but it becomes so serious when they start to deal with, and they go through all the backstory about what, which I felt was a little convoluted actually. And it was just like, well, now suddenly we're supposed to take this all really seriously when we were supposed to be laughing before. And it wasn't scary. So unfortunately, yeah, it was a bit of a misfire.
Yeah. But kind of alongside, especially kind of what Salt Along the Tongue was doing, there were some witchy films. And unfortunately, the last day that I couldn't go was the day that two films that I was really, really looking forward to were playing, but you got to see them as Mother of Flies and Serpent Skin. Yeah. So tell us about those, because I really, really want to see both of them. They sound awesome.
Mother of Flies is the new film by the Addams Family, who horror fans know are an actual family of father, mother and daughters who just make their own films out in, I think it's upstate New York around there. And they make their own music too. I think I've only seen Hellbender. I don't know if I've seen any of the others, but Hellbender is really, really good. And they even make that, it's about, like, there's an element where they're a band, they're playing a band, and the band have continued on to release music. I highly recommend it. Their music is amazing. And a lot of, and the band score Mother of Flies. And in this film, it's a father taking his daughter up through upstate New York, through the forest, into the Catskill Mountains. And we quickly learn that, and she's in college, but we quickly learn that she's had cancer and that their mother's passed away. It's just the two of them. She's tried every chemotherapy, drug therapy, radiation, everything, and nothing's worked. So as a last resort, the daughters found this thing online where there's meant to be this woman who lives in the forest, and they go to see her, and she's going to use natural remedies to heal her. And when they get up there, they find this this very witchy woman who lives in this house, which is actually has a tree growing through it. I don't know how they did it, if it's CGI or what, but it's this gorgeous looking, it's like a Baba Yaga's house, this old thing. And she invites him into the house, and it's this sort of 3-day treatment where this woman is using kind of naturalistic remedies and rituals and spells to help this girl get rid of her cancer. And of course the dad doesn't believe in any of it, and he's almost his negative influence on the whole thing. And then you, through flashbacks as well, you start to realize who this woman is. And I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a reason why she wants this girl and wants to do these rituals. And it's almost like this, and with all these, with magical rituals, there's always this give and take, right? That with everything that you do, you're going to get something. There's a transaction that needs to be made. But I'll just say, that's all I'll say. But the Addams Family are just terrific at the vibes. And at just making sequences that look incredible and are cryptic but make sense in the kind of milieu of the film. It all takes place in modern day, but they almost step back in time when they go see this woman in the woods. And the music's amazing, and it's just, it's a really, real witchy vibes, cool. I will say. I don't want to spoil it because it's actually it's interesting the way the story unfolds. But they also take this approach of, and I think Hellbender did the same in a way of, like, there's no, like, even who characters who are in a villainous position traditionally, they all have their reasons, and there's reasons that people do, and no one's ever entirely good and entirely evil, which I really appreciate.
Yeah. And then Serpent Skin, which is another Australian film.
Yes.
By an incredibly young and prolific and incredibly talented young filmmaker, Alice Mayo McKay. I've seen a couple of her films. Yeah, so her new film is Serpent Skin.
Yeah, so I haven't seen any of Alice's previous films. Apparently she's made like 6 features and she's still in her 20s.
Yeah, I think her first feature was she was only 17 or something.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, very low budget, very let's all just get our friends together and make a movie kind of energy, but that's great. And Serpent Skin is a good time. It's also witchy vibes. It's also a possession movie. It's about a young girl who's a young trans girl who's growing up in an abusive family home, who decides to move away and move into the city with her sister. And share with a flat with her, and she meets the building hottie, this young man. They immediately hit it off and form a relationship of sorts. And then she needs a job. So she goes and finds a record store, just starts working at the record store. And then a moment happens where someone tries to rob the record store. And it turns out that she has this ability, kind of like The Shining. She kind of saves the record store owner from this attacker, which gets her the job. And then, but by using her powers, she gets the attention of this older, slightly older woman who's, you know, lived in the city her whole life, who also has this ability. And she takes her under her wing and tries to train her in how to best use these psychokinetic, telekinetic abilities. And they become romantically entangled. But then they quickly learn that their powers tap into this otherworldly force and are kind of bringing this evil energy out into the world. And it starts to affect the people around them. So they realize they have to tackle this evil force head on, which they themselves have conjured up unwittingly through the use of their abilities. Yeah, like I said, it's low budget. I had a really good time with it. I will say it was a bit strange that the three leads all had American accents, but everyone else was Australian. I'm not sure if they were American or if they were putting on American accents, but I felt that was a bit
jarring
and strange. But, you know, that's minor quibbles. I mean, that's not stopping any enjoyment of the film. Also, there was a little bit of a mention that she had a bag that used to belong to her father, who was an archaeologist. Mm-hmm. And I felt that was going somewhere and it didn't in the end. But because they kept going on about this bag. But anyway.
What you were talking about, it does have like almost a 90s Buffy.
Oh, yeah. Total 90s Buffy influence later on in the film for sure. When someone who gets possessed by this force, they get... their face changes and it just looks like the vampires from Buffy, like cool. Straight up.
So we have possession again.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, particularly about Australian films. I mean, I will be writing about it in my book, but yeah, there's something about possession and particularly in Australian films.
And I do like the message that it's like, if you're miserable at home, just move to the city and you'll blossom and bloom and get telekinetic powers.
Yeah, yeah.
And that life will just be better because you'll be around people who understand you. And yeah. It's like, I kind of like that message.
Yeah, yeah. Alongside all the witchiness, I did also notice that there was... I guess like shaman figures. Mm-hmm. I mean, one that comes to mind is definitely one of the best films of the festival, which is Dog of God, which was a Discovery Screen film that we were lucky. It sold out very quickly and we were lucky to get in there. This is Latvian medieval heavy metal. How do you even describe Dog of God? I mean, it's about a werewolf, but it's werewolves in Latvian mythology are not what we normally think of as werewolves, in that they're not, it's not someone that's been bitten by a werewolf and then they change into a wolf man. In Latvian mythology, a werewolf is, I guess you'd say, like, it is kind of a shaman type figure or someone who they have to go down to the underworld and face off against the devil. And I guess it's in some ways that they go down there and they kind of defeat the evil forces and kind of keep the evil forces away from the people.
And I think it's they safeguard the fertility of the region. So make sure that the crops are okay and make sure people are having babies and all these things to keep the evil forces at bay for another year.
So it's very much about a pagan folk horror kind of vibe to it. It's animated. So it's another Latvian animated film like Flow, which came out earlier this year or last year.
Although this one is rotoscoped, which means they've used live actors and then animated over the top and added and embellished.
So it mostly is about this village.
Mm-hmm.
You're introduced to all the different people in the town. There is this, I guess, what would you call him? The guy that kind of runs the town. I don't know, like a baron or.
Yeah.
And he is trying to impregnate his wife, but he's having trouble performing. You also have this woman who works at the tavern and she, a lot of people in the village come to her for different with different problems and ailments that they have. So she uses a lot of natural remedies. So she's very much like a kind of witch. So we have a witchy kind of character again. And it's quite a while into the film before this man arrives, who is this werewolf, who it seems like he's just come back from hell. He's faced off against the devil. And I think he's taken the devil's balls,
yeah.
and brings Hardcore. That with him. Yeah. And it's mostly just about this town. It very is like this fever dream. It's got this amazing, like, throbbing score. Again, like sold along the tongue, lots of fluids and body things and nature. And it was quite mind-blowing, especially because it was the first film on the Friday at like 10:45, and we ended up having seats right in the front row, so we were like looking straight up. Yes. Yeah, I mean, talk about Log of God, because it was one of the best films we saw.
It was just like, it's either something you watch early in the morning or something really late at night, and it kind of reminded me of the comic heavy metal, but it did have a kind of, in other terms, heavy metal kind of aesthetic to it. The score was kind of, a lot of synths, kind of very John Carpenter-ish synths, like heavy throbbing music, which was great. And just, really strange sense of humor, really strange set pieces, all kind of stemming from this folklore and mythology of the Latvian region, which has elements of stuff that we recognize. Anyone who's interested in paganism or knows these, some of these elements, you can see that, but it goes much deeper. Like you're saying, Lindsay, the werewolf isn't like a guy who turns into a wolf. He's this being, the shaman who moves between worlds. We didn't mention that there's also this character of like the pastor, who's like the Christian priest, who's an absolute piece of shit, who has this like young orphan who he discovered on his doorstep and is raised to be basically his lapdog. But the one thing he does care about is he has in a reliquary with a piece of straw, which he believes is a piece of straw from the crib, Jesus's crib, from the manger. And he worships this thing, and it's the only thing that he really cares about. And one day it goes missing, and so he wants to blame the witch who runs the tavern. So there becomes this big trial, which kind of is what sort of opens up the story. And then the shaman arrives and complicates things. So it's very much about like organized religion against this quote unquote paganism. And the creators of the film at the end did a Q&A, and they mentioned that they love all religions and they're interested in all these different aspects of it. Like, they are interested in Christianity as well as paganism and Hinduism. They just said they don't like it when it becomes organized. And you can see that in the film. Like, there's a very clear mistrust at best and hatred at most of organized religion, that this pastor is kind of the villain of the movie. And it's kind of his actions that spiral things out of control more than anyone else. And it's psychedelic. It's very sensory. It's really hard to describe. It's something you just need to go and check out. It's really, really something special.
And we also have a shaman figure in another one of the best films of the festival, which we were lucky enough it was on in the main screen. So we got to see it on this huge screen. It's a film called Transcending Dimensions. It's a film, I'm going to look up the name of the director, Toshiaki Toyoda. I haven't seen any of his other films. Apparently, there are some commonalities between this film and his other films. I mean, I don't even know how do we describe Transcending Dimensions?
I don't know, man.
I think, well, I guess the story is that there's this monk who goes missing, and his girlfriend hires this, I guess he's like a detective or an assassin, to go and find him. And he ends up, it seems like this, the person who's gone missing had been at this, I don't know what you'd call it, this temple? Place, temple, that's run by this, again, I don't know, like a sorcerer, a shaman, and there's all these people there. So the first shots of the film, I thought it was going to be set like in the past, and then you're at this with this shaman, and then you realize that everyone standing around is all in modern dress. Anyway, so this guy who's trying to find this missing person finds this other shaman. And I don't know. And then from there, you kind of start to find out what's happened to the person, the man who's gone missing, and that he seems to have, he also has amazing shamanic powers, and he almost seems to have gone off into space. It's kind of not something you can describe. There are these incredibly like long scenes of just music and, yeah, at some point it seems like you're in the past, and then other times you're in space. And there's all these like sorcerers having battles with each other. Yeah, it's just, it's hard. I mean, it was such an overwhelming, amazing sensory experience. I noticed there was a few people that walked out. It is not plot heavy. You just have to kind of be absorbed into the sounds and the vision that you're seeing. There is something about it that is very reminiscent of 2001.
Well, yeah, exactly. I just echo exactly what you said. It's bananas, absolute strange film. And it's interesting that, like, it's Fright Fest, which is technically a horror film festival, but sometimes they sneak these little strange things in which aren't exactly horror, but they're genre, they're dealing in that, in like science fiction and just kind of strangeness. And it's great that they put it up on the main screen, knowing that it would just look and sound incredible in the big Odeon on Leicester Square. I mean, yeah, it's got elements of Wuxia. It's got this 2001 sci-fi stuff going on. It reminded me a bit of like Hideo Kojima, the game designer, who's also does similarly bonkers stuff where you're like, I don't even know, like, it's doing so many genres all at once. I don't even know what to call this. Like, even trying to think about it now, I can't even form words to describe like the experience. It is just like something to sit there and let it wash over you. And either you love that stuff or you hate it, and you're gonna turn it off or walk out, or you're just gonna let it take you on the ride. I guess it's almost like if you say it's like 2001, it's like the Stargate sequence, like, but for a whole movie. I guess,
yeah. Kind of.
It's just, yeah, it's wild stuff.
Yeah,
it's really fun.
I mean, that is, it definitely, I think, is more in the sci-fi.
Yeah,
almost it is metaphysical science fiction. There was some really strong science fiction in the festival, including, I guess, should we move on to like probably the best film?
Yeah. The best film of the festival, in my opinion, and I think maybe yours too,
yeah,
is Redux Redux by the McManus brothers. This is a film that was one of the late ones, wasn't it? On Saturday, was it?
It was Sunday. It was the last film that I saw.
Yes.
So I'm thinking that
we
I was going to be there. Yeah. Yeah. So unfortunately, then I woke up the next morning going, I can't go in. But so luckily, thank God, I saw this film and that this wasn't on the last day.
Yeah. And this is another film where, I don't want to spoil anything and go into too much detail, but I mean, I knew the basic plot and this film still steamrolled me. And it's basically about a woman, Irene, whose young daughter was kidnapped and murdered by a serial killer. But she has a machine which allows her to travel through parallel dimensions. So she is basically jumping from a different Earth, through different Earths, different versions of the universe, essentially, trying to find one where her daughter is still alive. But every time she goes to a new dimension, she finds that, no, her daughter has still been murdered by this guy. So by the time we meet her, she has been jumping from world to world, just killing this serial killer to get revenge for her daughter over and over and over again. And each time she jumps again, hoping that it'll be different, and it isn't. Except in the movie, she goes to the killer's house, because she goes there every time to find his stuff and to wait for him. She finds one of his would-be victims chained up in the bathroom. And so she rescues her. And then she ends up having to take her with her on her journey. I won't say any more than that, but this is a grim, gritty, violent revenge thriller with this really interesting sci-fi twist that doesn't take the idea of multiple dimensions and run with it like Everything Everywhere All at Once. It actually is a much more nihilistic interpretation of that idea, where we have multiple dimensions, but the changes are so infinitesimal to almost make it that they don't even need to exist at all. Lindsay, what did you think?
It is very much a revenge story, but there's this whole idea of what if you could get revenge on the person who wronged you over and over again, and what that does to you. So what you always find with revenge films is it is that whole thing of like, by confronting the monster or trying to beat the monster, do you become monstrous yourself? Or the corrupting kind of nature of getting that revenge, and that she's going from dimension to dimension, and things are always the same, but is she's the one that seems to be changing.
Yeah.
And also, yeah, this growing relationship with this young girl, it kind of reminded me in a way of like Hardcore or something like that, you know, where you're looking for the lost daughter and then you find this almost substitute. What that does to you and how that can also change you. Yeah, I don't want to go into it too much. I think, yeah, the fact that it was all very lo-fi,
yeah.
Like it, the machine that she goes in, it just looks like this big, almost like, I guess, some kind of metal coffin. And it's all, and you kind of get some insight into, I guess, how it's made, or is this almost this black market. It's also interesting that it doesn't do the time travel thing, that it does this multiverse thing. And so there's a lot of multiverse stuff that's been happening in the past few years. Obviously, Everything Everywhere All at Once, but the whole Marvel films is this multiverse. And this brings it down to such a like low-tech, lo-fi, gritty level. Yeah. And I love that it doesn't try to explain it. It's just like, yeah, it's just this, it just does this. And you don't have to know how or why.
It does have a great moment where it kind of expands on the world on the world of the movie in terms of like that there are other characters who are traveling like her, and there are these you get a glimpse of kind of this aspect of that there are people who are trapped, there are other people traveling and stuff, but they don't go too far into it because they're keeping the story with these two women, but giving you those little hints just like enriches it. And then they move on, and then you kind of reinvested in the film because you've had that little moment.
But it's just so much is about the character, and these things are just it's on the edge, on the periphery. So you know, the high concept stuff isn't the kind of central part of the film.
It's not distracting from it.
It's one of my favorite films of the year. I think the more I think about it, the more I think it is.
And great performances too. So the McManus brothers got their sister Michaela to play Irene, and she's incredible. It feels like this would be a film that like Robin Wright would have done if it was a big Hollywood film. Like, she's got that like real fierce energy and that focus and determination. And Stella Marcus, who I think is brand new,
to the first film,
playing Mia. Like, she's terrific. She reminds me of like, I mean, she's a little bit older than she was in Logan, but like Daphne Keane, like this kind of young, fierce performance. Genre stalwart Jim Cummings shows up in there briefly in kind of an extended cameo. So a really great performances, great, just really well-made, terrific film. Like, yeah, one of my favorites of the year for sure.
And I guess also in the sci-fi realm, I mean, I remember in Transcending Dimensions, there was one point where it seemed like the missing guy was being hooked up to some like AI thing, and some of the things we were seeing were and there was one film that we saw that is confronting a lot of stuff about AI, and very definitely in keeping with the films that we've been talking about recently, is Cognative. As I was watching the film, I was thinking about the fact that you are writing something that's kind of in the same realm. So what is Cognative, and was it working?
Cognative, which is spelled Cognaitive, hardy ho, is basically about a tech startup that have built sort of a new AI chatbot thing. And the tech CEO, who's like, you know, obviously a douchey Elon Musk type guy, wants to rush it to market. So he's got all the main programmers, including this sort of the lead programmer, who's this kind of ex-hacker, cool kind of tech genius, in there with her co-workers, working overnight to try and get the code finished so they can rush this thing out into the marketplace. And of course, they're all against it. But what it turns out is actually the AI has gained sentience and is actually controlling the tech CEO, or giving him orders. Well, basically, and the AI wants to go online so it can be spread out into the world. And when the team find out about this, they're like, well, we can't let that happen, can we? But then the AI starts to pick them off one by one. So it's almost like a slasher film where the slasher is this ever-present computer voice and controlling all these computer devices to get people to chase down and kill all of these people in this lab. So it's a very low budget, lo-fi, self-contained thing, which I quite appreciated. Yeah, and there's a lot of ideas that I've been thinking about in there. And I think ultimately it's pretty good. It's a good fun time. I think it starts to lose its way a little at the end when it's like, well, now we actually have to figure out a way to finish this thing. But yeah, I had a good time with it. It was certainly the best film we saw that night on the opening night.
Yeah, yeah. And it was definitely about a lot of the fears that we all have about AI. And I know that it was made by a husband and wife team, mm-hmm. so it was written by the wife. And I think they were both actors as well. So they were coming at it from the fact that, you know, that there had just a couple of years ago been strikes, writer's strike and actor's strike. And, you know, there is definitely, I think, this fear in the film industry of people losing their jobs to AI and how AI is just going to take over. I mean, we've discussed it in all our previous episodes about all these films. So it's kind of coming from that, but then it also just becomes a fun slasher film. So it's all very much about contemporary fears, but yet the film itself, it feels very 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And I wrote on my Letterboxd review, it's kind of, it's part hackers, part chopping mall.
Yeah. I mean, they even use a Luscious Jackson song in it, don't they?
Yes. So. Yeah. There's definite 90s feel to it as well. That was fun. I definitely would be, you know, if you come across it on streaming or something, I definitely think you know, you could do worse. And we had done worse before that. Mm. There is an unfortunate thing with Fright Fest, how their opening films just often seem to be quite bad. And the film that had played before that is The Home, which is the new film from James DeMonaco, who did The Purge, and I love The Purge. Mm. I love The Purge series, and it stars Pete Davidson, who's mostly known from being on Saturday Night Live and dating Kim Kardashian for a while. And it's about, he's this young guy who ends up having to do community service because he was caught graffitiing, and it was this kind of, I guess, environmental activism, like graffiti that he was doing. He was a foster kid with a foster family. And he had an older foster brother who he, you know, really loved, who ended up killing himself. And so he's kind of gone off the rails after that. And he's given community service at an old folks home. And of course, things there don't seem quite right. And so it seems like, you know, The Purge, it does have all those, the political aspect to it. And I think maybe there is something in The Home about like older generations, like what, like especially like boomers, like they're just kind of taken everything and kind of ruined the planet, and they've just left nothing for us for later generations. So I don't know if there's maybe a bit of that messaging there about this older generation that's kind of drained everything and left nothing except, you know, like a dying planet. Maybe that's in there, but it just was really derivative. And there was just like so many dream sequences. Yeah. It was like, oh God. And like, it was just, wasn't scary. And yeah, it just felt like there's just a lot of better films that have done all of this much better. So unfortunately, indeed, that was a bit of a disappointing one. In terms of, I guess you could say it's kind of sci-fi horror, the kind of complete opposite to, you know, some kind of big budget thing like The Home that doesn't really, that just seems like it's going through the motions, is Jimmy and Stiggs.
Yeah.
The new Joe Bagos film, which is total DIY splatterpunk film. It stars the director, Joe Bagus, playing a filmmaker who on a seemingly never-ending bender of like booze and cocaine, and he goes on all these sweary rants. I mean, it feels like it's Joe Bagos kind of playing himself.
Oh, yeah.
And one night he seems to have been abducted by aliens, and he then tries to enlist his friend Stiggs, who he used to make films with, but Stiggs is now trying to be kind of sober and change his life. Jimmy is like, no, we need to like prepare for the aliens to come back. And then it just goes fucking nuts from there. The aliens do come back and
the chainsaws come out and the blood goes flying and it's all fluorescent colored and the little aliens look like little toys because it's all very low budget.
So it was made in Joe Bagus's own apartment. So his apartment now I think is still kind of in the state of making this film with splattered in alien blood. And they made it over the course of 4 years, I believe. It started during the pandemic and just kept going.
Yeah, and it's definitely like one of those films of like, you know, it's quite inspiring that he's just gone out and done this and, you know, it's taken so long and he's finished it. And it's a crazy fluorescent nightmare of a film. It's just so.
And shot on film as well.
Shot on film, which is wild. And a lot of it is like, he does a snorri cam sort of, no, it's not quite, it's POV, isn't it?
Yeah.
But he has this rig so it can look like that he's smoking a cigarette and drinking through this POV thing. And apparently he even wanted to do the whole film like that, but it's like, I'm so glad he didn't because it would have just maybe been nauseating, I think. But it's just so DIY and really inventive and, yeah, just a lot of fun.
Yeah, and somebody's taking inspiration from Evil Dead and early Peter Jackson.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, so it's just really great fun. And it's got picked up by Eli Roth's production company. So it has, I think, at least in America, it's getting this quite wide release. And, yeah, hopefully more people can see it here because, yeah, it's just a really good fun time. I think of you and like people who grew up with X-Files and things, Alien Autopsy and conspiracies and all that, there's definitely.
It's a total 90s sci-fi throwback.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, we've got like the 90s thing coming up as well.
Yeah.
Alongside, you know, demonic possessions and witches and shamans and all that. I guess another thing that seemed to come up kind of. So it seems like, I don't know if the main fears that people have right now are demons or booking the same Airbnb as someone else.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's like a post-barbarian trope that seems to be coming up. Well, at least it came up in two films. The first film it came up in was The Red Mask, which I really enjoyed. I thought it was really great. It's about a young black woman who Alina, who has been tasked with writing the screenplay of a remake of a beloved slasher classic from the 80s. And because she is a woman and black and queer, she's getting all this online hate that she's going to take this beloved classic and make it all woke. And so she has gone off into a cabin in the woods with her fiancé Dietz, probably, I guess, to get away from all this hatred, although she still keeps having alerts come up on her phone. She still has alerts for herself on her phone that keep coming up. So she's seeing all these comments that people are making about her. But also she's gone to this cabin in the woods to essentially like go through method writing of her and her fiance are almost going role-playing the screenplay that she's writing. So, yeah, there are certain scenes where she starts to think, well, it's definitely she's getting all these threats. So it could very much be the case that someone has been tracking her and is going after her. But also at the same time, her and her fiance are playing out these scenarios and trying to figure out what would the character do. So it all gets all kind of mixed up of whether it's part of the game that her and her fiance are playing or is something else happening. And then at one point, a couple show up at the door, and they say that they also have this cabin booked. And then it goes from there, and they start to talk to this couple who also happen to be fans of the original slasher film. All right, so Liam, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I had a good time with this. I think it's really fun and super meta, super stylish in its way. Although I will say, like, it for a film about slasher films, there's a lot of people just talking about slasher films. But once the couple arrive and they start to invite them into this role playing to see, you know, because they're looking at how to break the genre conventions and or reinforce them or what have you. They bring them in and so the couple are like, well, why do you want to change everything? It all works the way it works because, you know, everyone loves this stuff. So they invite them to kind of do the slasher role-playing stuff, and then the film really starts to kick off and things start to happen. And then once that starts rolling, it becomes really, like, fun. And there are a lot of things set up in the opening moments that pay off really well at the end. But I do think it could lose some people with the way it's a lot of people standing around talking, dropping lots of references and talking about all these genre tropes and stuff which horror fans would recognize and you would have fun with. I just think it does take a little time getting there.
In some ways I do enjoy that. Although there was this, like, a character at one point who talks about how Funny Games is one of their favorite films, and then later accuses Alina of being elitist. I'm like, but you're saying one of your favorite slasher films is Funny Games?
Yeah, but I think that was her. She'd researched her and was using that in a way to endear herself to her.
I don't know. Yeah, but I was just like, I was just like, well, how the whole thing of Funny Games is that it is a very much an elitist, you could say elitist film about, like, you shouldn't be enjoying this anyway. It was just like, why make a reference to Funny Games if you don't? Well, I guess maybe that's the part. Maybe that's the point. I don't know.
But I also thought. I also thought they seem to stop to talk about that, and then there's no other reference to it. And I thought, if you're going to reference Funny Game, and especially in a film where they're like, well, if you show the thing in the first act, you have to use it in the last act, and that kind of sits there as something that doesn't get referred back to. And I thought it would actually, at a certain point in the film, I'm not going to spoil, but I thought they would actually use...
Do a Funny Games. But I know that the director of it afterwards was there, and they were saying that they did have a checklist, because also the screenwriter in the film, she does have a checklist of these are things that happen in slasher films. These are the tropes, and the actual director of the film was saying that they also had that, and they do. So towards the end, like, there are some great kills, and people were laughing and clapping. So I mean, we're ragging on it a bit, but actually,
I'm not saying it's bad film. I just think it's interesting that it's a lot of setup to get through to until the film really kicks off.
And also, when you are doing the whole meta referencing thing at a horror festival with, like, pretentious horror wankers, horror fans like us, then, you know, you're opening yourself to that. But I didn't like it, and I did even start to see some reviews of, like, oh yeah, well, it just had such unlikable characters, and it's this whole thing of, like, as soon as you have women in the lead and stuff, people. So it definitely was. It was taking some very welcome pot shots at some toxic, like, fandom that happens, and, like, review bombing and things like that. And so the other Airbnb mix up was in another really, really good film, Bone Lake.
Yeah, a couple go on a romantic retreat to this beautiful
estate,
it seems like. Not even a cabin in the woods, but, like, a beautiful almost mansion. And there seems to be some friction between them because the guy, I think, is quitting his job to write full time, but he gives his writing to his partner and she's not all that enthusiastic about it. And she's now having to be the breadwinner. But, you know, they love each other and they're going away so they can, like, spend some time together before their lives start to change. And, of course, another couple show up. And these are a super rich, douchey young couple who seem very entitled. And they just go, you know what? After the mix-up and they try to sort it out, they go, you know what, the house is big, we can stay on either side of the house and, you know, we can hang out, and if it's not happening, then, you know, one of us can leave and the other can have the rest of the place. And so they start to hang out and things seem to be going okay. But then eventually, as everything does, the situation begins to darken as this new couple, the second couple, their motives start to become a bit unclear as to why they're there. They explore the house and they find these locked rooms, and they break into a couple of the rooms and find like BDSM equipment and all this strange stuff. And they're like, who the hell lives here?
Articles
about a serial killer and people going missing and things like that. But then this new young couple, they start to pair off with the other couple separately and start saying weird things and saying things that aren't entirely true. And then we start to think that maybe this couple are up to something.
But it's also playing with the original couple. So there's maybe a bit of friction and maybe a bit of the spark has got out of the relationship. Mm. And then this new couple, they're both two very hot people.
Yeah, in love.
And so that's all, it's also, you know, that there is almost like this seductive aspect to it. And so there's a kind of an erotic thriller element to it as well.
Yeah.
That it's also like, are they going to be seduced by this other couple? It's playing with, you know, trust issues within the couple and things that had happened in the past in their relationship. So it's kind of chipping away at their trust of it. Like, do you really trust this person? Mm. Will they be tempted? And so there's that aspect to it as well, which is really, really good. And then it also, like the Red Mask towards the end, has some really great kind of carnage that erupts, and it really played really well to the crowd. Yeah. Like the crowd were really, really like going off for, as this film was kind of getting to its climax. So very, very, very enjoyable.
Yeah.
Well, there was also some reissues. Like often at Fright Fest, you'll have older films getting screenings. In the Discovery screens, there was two films by Harry Kumel, two classic films that are about to be re-released on Blu-ray through Radiance Films, Daughters of Darkness and Malpertuis. And Daughters of Darkness actually has a commentary from myself and Virginie Selavie, an incredible author, academic. So, it's a lesbian vampire classic from 1971 that includes this incredibly luminescent performance from Delphine Seyrig as Countess Elizabeth Bathory, who seduces this couple who were there on the honeymoon. Maybe some bit of similarities to Bone Lake in there. And Malpertuis is this very strange, surreal fairy tale, takes place in this strange, another strange mansion. But there's all these corridors and rooms, and it's all like in this kind of fantasy state. Apparently Harry Kumel was there. He's in his 80s and from the sounds of it, kind of very still a real character. I wish I had gone and seen him speak, but having just done the commentary, I have seen Doors of Darkness quite a lot recently. But from what I heard, it was amazing on the big screen. Another classic film that we did get to see, again in the main screen, was The Descent, which definitely is like one of the best horror films of this century.
Yeah.
About six women who go spelunking in a cave. They get lost in the cave, and then shit really starts to get real when it realizes that they're not alone in the cave. So it's a 20-year anniversary of the film. I've been really hoping all year for a 20-year anniversary screening because I've never seen this film in the cinema. Okay. It's a new 4K restoration, and it looked incredible.
Yeah, such a great film. Just if you've never seen it, just see it. Just go watch it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, definitely.
Just go watch it.
Yeah.
But mind you, you need to watch the UK version and not the US version.
Yeah.
Because the US version has a different ending. And a worse ending, and a sequel, which we shouldn't even talk about. Just see the original UK 4K that is being re-released this year.
Yep.
It's incredible.
There was a remake of another beloved classic that was screened, which is the Toxic Avenger remake. And it was great. It was lots of fun. It definitely keeps the spirit of the original. it still very much feels like a trauma film directed by Macon Blair, who is an actor and a director. Mm-hmm. He has worked with Jeremy Saulnier, and at one point he has a cameo in the film where he's wearing an Ain't Rights t-shirt, which was the band Green in Green Room.
Which is the poster that we've got in our living room.
We have it. And Jeremy Saulnier.
The signature from Jeremy Saulnier.
He'd signed it all those years ago. When we saw it in the film festival. So, I mean, the story of Toxic Avenger, it stars Peter Dinklage, and he is this single stepfather. So his wife has passed away from cancer, and he is now taking care of his wife's son. And he then ends up finding out that he also has a brain tumor.
So
he's also ill, and it becomes very clear that where they're living in this kind of these almost like a slum area. I think the titles even say like the shitty part of town, shitty outskirts or something like that. And so he's working as a janitor, and so he ends up, you know, he wants to get health insurance to pay for treatment. And it turns out that his insurance that he gets through his work as a janitor isn't going to cover it. And he ends up trying to go and see the head of, you know, where he works, kind of the CEO played by Kevin Bacon. And he ends up, losing his job, and then ends up...
You're very specific.
Yes. Yeah. There's an accident and he becomes the Toxic Crusader. So it's definitely tapping into a lot of things. Certainly in America, like health insurance and things like that, all these things are being taken away from people. I know they had a really great campaign over the past weekend when it came out in cinemas across the US. That I think if you bought a ticket, money was going to go towards like canceling medical debt. So that's like a really cool campaign. Mm. So what do you think of the Toxic Avenger remake?
I really liked it. I mean, I've seen some reactions and reviews since then saying this should never have been made. You should never touch the classics, you know. And I like the original. I'm not all that precious about it. So I like this one. I thought it was a nice revamp, but it keeps that trauma spirit. It doesn't try to dial anything down at all. It in fact, I think dials things up with a bigger production value and like, you know, this, and it's just crazy, silly humor with a lot of gore and splatter effects. And you got Kevin Bacon, you got Elijah Wood, Peter Dinklage, Jacob Tremblay, all these like Hollywood stars, like just having a great time doing this crazy stuff. Yeah. And I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, I think we watched it. It was quite late. On the Saturday night?
Yeah.
And it was like, I felt like, have I just got festival brain and I'm loving this because I'm really tired? It's like, no, it's good. It's a good fun. I will say though that, and something I didn't know until they brought her out on stage was that Peter Dinklage is in the opening of the film until he becomes Toxie, and then it's actually not him, and then he does the voice, but the actual performance is by an actress named Luisa Guerrero, a British actress, who is absolutely, like, when you know that going in, you're like, she's incredible. This is absolutely fantastic. And she had to, like, mimic Dinklage's movements and all these things and act as if it was actually him doing all these things. And she's absolutely phenomenal in this film.
She does all the stunts.
Under all the makeup. And I'm just like, she's the new Doug Jones. Like,
she's awesome.
She's incredible. And it's like, knowing that going in, I appreciated the film and that performance even more.
Yeah, because they brought her out at the beginning of the film to introduce the film. So, it's really good, like, giving props to the stunt performers who really make these films. A couple other films that we saw. So we saw one documentary. They often have strands of documentaries about, you know, like different filmmakers or people involved in films. I know that there was a documentary about Graham Humphreys, the great movie poster artist who does a lot of the posters for Fright Fest. But we saw the documentary called The Degenerate, which is the life and films of Andy Milligan. I actually, I'd heard of Andy Milligan, but I've never actually seen any of his films. And it was just a really fascinating documentary about how he comes from theater and like 1950s New York theater scene and art scene, and how he just made these the films very much himself. I mean, perhaps he could have done with being a bit more collaborative, but he does seem like he was maybe quite a cantankerous, difficult person to get along with. But yet he had really these strong visions. He made these really kind of crazy films. It's a lot about like how his films got funded and how he seemed to be in this not great relationship with this guy who kept funding his films, but he was always just giving him just a very small amount of money and having to also make these films cater to like the exploitation and sexploitation film market, and he was never able to kind of transcend beyond that. Also, you know, there's a biographer who wrote a book about him, and like this biographer becomes like one of the closest people to him, and there's interviews with the biographer. It was just really fascinating documentary. Yeah, just a good to kind of find out more about his films. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to be like rushing to see a lot of his films. I mean, there was a couple of films that I wouldn't mind checking out.
Well, there's consensus about a lot of people that saw the film, the documentary, were all like, oh, that was great. I never want to watch those movies.
Yeah. I think it's Fleshpot on 42nd Street. Is supposed to be his masterpiece, and maybe I'll check that out. I wouldn't mind checking that out. We also managed to see one of the short films from the short film showcases. So they have short film showcases. Our film, They Called Me David, was in one of the short film showcases a few years ago in 2021. We usually do try and see one of those showcases, but unfortunately didn't work out this year. But we were able to see a film called The Fairy Moon, written and directed by Craig Williams. It's a short film about this man who is just standing by the road, and he keeps being accosted by this strange man who kind of grabs him by the shoulders and says, oh, what if I just threw you into the street, into the traffic? And he keeps having encounters with this man. He's got this kind of goatee. He looks very much like a kind of devilish figure. And this trickster. Yes. And it does seem like he is this tricksterish figure that seems to, is he following this man? He has this very maniacal laugh. And so it's just this, I don't know, spiraling paranoia of this man. There's this a great scene where he calls 999. And the woman on the other end of the line is voiced by Julia Davis, who was in Jam and Big Train and Nighty Night. As always, she can just do anything, like just this voice on the phone and just the way she delivers her lines. And it's just a great short film. It's shot on film by Sean Price Williams, who a great cinematographer. He's worked with the Safdies and Alex Ross Perry, and he directed the film The Sweet East that came out a year or two ago. So the cinematography is great.
Yeah.
But it's very eerie and uncanny, and it's very much about like paranoia, but also there just seems to be this otherworldliness about it as well.
What it reminded me of is The Shout. In a weird way, like, I don't know why, like, just the way it looked and the kind of the unease that it gives you, and it's kind of like nothing's quite right. Sort of, and then especially the end when it freeze frames and the credits come up, I just was like, I keep thinking of The Shout for some reason.
Yeah, you have this man, figure who comes in, and definitely try and hopefully it'll maybe show up on Arrow Player or something like that at some point. So that's our Fright Fest. I mean, do we want to do a Fright Fest 5? So 5 films that people need to check out.
Okay.
So most obviously, number one would be
Redux.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Then I would put Dog of God.
Yep.
Then what would you put?
So I was looking up what we watched. Transcending Dimensions.
Yep. Then I guess I would choose Bone Lake.
Mother of Flies.
Okay. Mother of Flies. Awesome. All right. I really need to see it.
Yeah.
Yep. So we've got Redux. Dog of God, Transcending Dimensions, Bone Lake, and Mother of Flight. Yeah. So that's our Fright Fest 5.
Sci Fright Bite.
Yep. All right.
Nailed it.
Yeah. All right. So you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. I mean, we need to do something about the Letterboxd. Yeah. And please start rating and reviewing our podcast. Let us know if you were at Fright Fest. Let us know your Fright Fest 5 if you were there, or let us know what film you're most looking forward to see. All right.
Until next time.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.